KSDP 830 AM Sandpoint, K201DA King Cove, KFPS False Pass.
Good morning. The mayor of Washington, D.C. says the district will push back against any federal effort to end residents' home rule. We speak with Mayor Muriel Bowser on Morning Edition from NPR News. Immigration agents arrested a permanent resident who helped to lead student protests against the war in Gaza. I'm Steve Inskeep.
Enemy Martinez, his arrest comes after the Trump administration's executive order to, quote, combat anti-Semitism on college campuses. Also, state Supreme Court elections used to be afterthoughts. Now they're more expensive and competitive than ever. And a change for a Rhode Island delicacy, hot wieners. It's Monday, March 10th. Happy birthday to actress Jasmine Guy. In this world, not a different one, she turned 63. The news is next.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Corva Coleman. Stocks tumbled this morning as investors brace for more tariffs this week. NPR's Scott Horsley reports the Dow Jones Industrial Average slid about 370 points in early trading.
Commerce Secretary Howard Lutnick says new tariffs on imported steel and aluminum will take effect Wednesday as scheduled. That's the same day the government set to report on inflation for the month of February. Economists say the 25% import taxes could raise the price of cars, appliances, canned goods, and soda pop. They could also trigger retaliatory tariffs on U.S. exports. President Trump downplayed the fallout, though in an interview with Fox News, he acknowledged there could be a drag on economic growth. The online mortgage lender Rocket Companies is buying the internet real estate broker Redfin in a deal valued at $1.75 billion. Rocket says the combination will create a one-stop shop for both houses and home loans. Scott Horsley, NPR News, Washington.
Canada's ruling Liberal Party has chosen a new leader. Former Canadian Central Bank Governor Mark Carney will take over from Liberal Party leader Justin Trudeau. It also means Carney will soon take over as Canada's prime minister. Carney says he will resist President Trump's economic tariffs and battle Trump's declaration that the U.S. will grab Canada for its own.
Canada never, ever will be part of America in any way, shape, or form. We didn't ask for this fight, but Canadians are always ready when someone else drops the gloves. So the Americans, they should make no mistake, in trade as in hockey, Canada will win.
China has also taken steps today to resist President Trump's new 20% tariffs on that country. China has slapped tariffs of 10 to 15% of its own on a wide variety of U.S. agricultural goods. Ukraine hit several Russian oil refineries and depots with drones overnight. That's according to Ukrainian media and online footage. NPR's Eleanor Beardsley reports the attacks are part of Ukraine's attempt to undermine Moscow's capacity to wage war.
Video footage posted online shows a large fire burning in a warehouse in the Samara region of Russia, a major production center for high-grade jet fuel used in Russian planes that launch missiles at Ukraine. A large explosion was also reported in the Novokoybyshevsk oil refinery there. The Samara region is nearly 1,000 miles from Ukraine's eastern border. Kyiv has systematically and often successfully targeted Russian oil refineries, military sites, and warehouses deep behind the front lines. Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky is set to meet with U.S. officials in Saudi Arabia Tuesday to begin negotiations to end the war. Eleanor Beardsley, NPR News, Lviv.
On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials are down nearly 1%. The Nasdaq is down more than 2%. This is NPR. House Republicans have unveiled a stopgap federal spending bill. Congress only has until Friday night to avert a partial federal government shutdown. It's unclear if House Republicans have enough votes among themselves to pass the measure. Even if it does pass the House, the bill must also pass the Senate, where its chances could be harder. In Germany, strikes at almost every airport have brought air travel to a standstill today. As Esme Nicholson reports, the walkout marks a major escalation over wage negotiations.
Ground staff have laid down tools for 24 hours at nearly every airport across Germany, including the international hubs Frankfurt and Munich. The Federal Airport Association says the industrial action will impact more than 500,000 passengers at 13 airports until midnight today. Staff at Hamburg Airport walked out earlier than expected on Sunday and without giving prior notice, leaving some passengers stranded after checking in, a move an airport spokesperson called excessive and dishonourable. Trade union Verdi is demanding a collective wage deal that includes an 8% pay increase, higher bonuses and additional vacation. For NPR News, I'm Esme Nicholson in Berlin.
Authorities in southern Pennsylvania say a small plane crashed in Lancaster County yesterday. The five people aboard were hospitalized. No one on the ground was hurt. There have been a string of plane accidents in the past few weeks in the U.S. That includes the deadly crash of a small plane on a medical flight outside Philadelphia at the end of January. Also in January, 67 people died when two aircraft collided at an airport outside of Washington. This is NPR.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include Jarl and Pamela Mohn, focusing on civil liberties, foster youth, public radio, and the arts. And the Public Welfare Foundation, committed to advancing transformative youth and criminal justice reforms.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Amy Martinez in Los Angeles, California.
And I'm Steve Inskeep in Washington, D.C. Coming up, Michelle talks with the mayor of Washington. Muriel Bowser is fielding a complaint from one of her constituents who recently moved back into town. First, the Trump administration acted against a former student.
Immigration agents have arrested an activist who helped lead pro-Palestinian student protests at Columbia University.
His name is Mahmoud Khalil. His lawyer tells NPR that officers from ICE, that's Immigration and Customs Enforcement, picked him up at his university apartment. They told him his green card had been revoked. Green card. He was a lawful permanent resident. President Trump had promised to deport students who protested against Israel during the war in Gaza.
NPR's Adrian Florido is here with us now. So tell us who Mahmoud Khalil is and what happened to him.
Well, Khalil A. was one of the Palestinian students who last year negotiated on behalf of the campus protesters who were pressing Columbia to divest from Israel over the Gaza war. He was outspoken, very involved. He recently graduated. I spoke with his lawyer, and she told me that on Saturday night, Khalil and his wife were arriving at their university apartment and that ICE agents were in the lobby. They told Khalil his student visa had been canceled. But Khalil is not on a visa. He is a legal permanent resident. When his wife went to get his green card out of the apartment, agents said that it had been revoked.
Did they give a reason?
Well, his lawyer, Amy Greer, says she spoke with one of the agents on the phone during the arrest, and he didn't give her a reason.
And I demanded to see a warrant or have a warrant shown to me or Mr. Khalil before they removed him, and the agent hung up the phone on me.
Greer said that she was shocked the government had declared his green card revoked without due process.
Mr. Khalil was under the impression that as a lawful permanent resident, that he had some modicum of protection that may not exist for people who do have student visas or who are undocumented.
Instead, agents drove Khalil to a detention center, she said, while his pregnant wife, a U.S. citizen, stayed behind.
Okay. Now, what are you learning about what's behind all this, possibly?
Well, I got a statement last night from DHS spokeswoman Tricia McLaughlin. She said Khalil had been arrested in support of a recent executive order that President Trump signed on anti-Semitism. She said Khalil had, quote, led activities aligned to Hamas, a designated terrorist organization. Separately, in a post on X, Secretary of State Marco Rubio linked to a news story about Khalil's arrest and wrote that the administration would be revoking the visas or green cards of Hamas supporters so they can be deported.
Can you give us just maybe a little more context about the government's motives here?
Well, conservative lawmakers have really tried to label pro-Palestinian protesters as pro-Hamas, pro-terrorist, or anti-Semitic. In late January, President Trump signed an executive order that he said would be used to go after students who participated in his words, the pro-jihadist protests. The order cited federal law that allows deporting foreign nationals who express support for terrorism. Students have always rejected, A, the claim that their protests were pro-terrorist or that they supported Hamas's 2023 attack on Israel. They say the protests were for peace in Gaza.
How are people responding to this arrest?
Well, student activists are denouncing it as a chilling attempt to use deportation to stifle free speech and to repress pro-Palestinian activism and criticism of Israel. Khalil's attorney, Amy Greer, told me that she has a legal team that is trying to find out where he's being held and that plans to defend him and to ensure that he gets due process.
All right, that's NPR's Adrian Florido. Thanks a lot.
Thank you, A.
Washington, D.C. will start removing a mural today that marks a space near the White House. The words Black Lives Matter are on the street in giant yellow letters. The city will also rename Black Lives Matter Plaza after a member of Congress introduced a bill to pull federal funding if the name should stay. The federal government holds far more power over the district than it does over other cities, so it also mattered when President Trump made a demand that the mayor clean up homeless encampments or federal officials, quote, will be forced to do it for her. Michelle Martin spoke with Mayor Muriel Bowser.
I think the president doesn't think there should be any homeless person in the nation's capital. I mean, if I'm being like perfectly blunt, I think that there is a opportunity, and there has been in all the years I've been mayor, to work with the federal government, because a lot, unfortunately, of encampments, they appear on federal park space. I think one thing that I want your listeners to understand is we have shelter space for every person that you see outside. And dealing with an encampment population is among the most difficult human services work that you will do, because people have decided that they want to stay outside and not go into shelter. But we have been successful. I think in the last 2 years, we've seen the number of tents and the number of encampments cut almost in half.
His view of the crime environment in D.C. also seems to be a pain point. Like in recent days on his social media account, Trump also said, quote, Washington, D.C. must become clean and safe. So let's talk about the street crime issue. Tell us the latest on that.
Cities deal with crime and cities deal with homelessness. It's urban life. But what isn't normal is having massive firings and layoffs that's tanking the economy of the nation's capital, which will create a situation that is antithetical to what the president and I agree on, how to make Washington, D.C. the most beautiful city in the world. You don't make a city beautiful by gutting its workforce. You don't make a city beautiful by leaving buildings vacant. The actions of the federal government are working against our ability to invest in our city.
Well, let's talk about that. What is the impact so far of these mass firings?
Well, we estimate that 40,000 D.C. residents will be put out of work through no fault of their own in this process. And we also recognize that there are a lot of questions about the legality of these actions. What it will mean for us immediately is a decrease in what we estimate in the revenue that we're going to bring in. When people are out of work, guess what? They don't pay taxes. They don't shop at stores. They don't go to restaurants. They don't book hotels.
There is this bill to force you to rename the two-block stretch of 16th Street Northwest from Black Lives Plaza to Liberty Plaza.
That came from the Congress. Anyone who was paying attention at that time would recognize that our mural allowed us to get control of our city at a very dark time in American history.
But you are going to paint it over.
It's going to evolve, absolutely.
Before we let you go, Mayor, I want to let everybody understand that the district has a governance system that is unlike that of other areas. You know, given that, how do you move forward here in expressing the wishes of your constituents and trying to navigate this period when there are some stark ideological differences about what is best for the city going forward?
We are unique in the American system. We are a city, a county, a state all at once. We pay federal taxes, but we're not represented. And so there is no jurisdiction that has the type of relationship that we have with the federal government, both in geographic proximity, but also in a legal relationship. So that's why the DC mayor and the American president always work closely together. And so what I hope you recognize is that unlike a lot of Democrats in my position, we do go directly to the president. We do work with the president, and we will defend our city.
That is the mayor of Washington, DC, Muriel Bowser. Madam Mayor, thank you so much for talking with us once again.
Thank you.
Syria's president is calling for unity after hundreds of members of a religious minority were killed in the country's coastal region. It's being called a massacre, revenge attacks after an ambush of government security forces. NPR's Jana Raff has more from Damascus.
Syria's president, Ahmed Ashara, spoke at pre-dawn prayers at a mosque on Sunday, urging peace. A grainy cell phone video seems to be the only posted recording. Dressed in a black leather jacket, Shara addressed worshippers in the Damascus mosque he attended as a child. We can live together, he told them. He said challenges were expected in the new Syria. But this challenge is the biggest since Shara's coalition of forces toppled President Bashar al-Assad last December. The Syrian government has sealed off the areas where the killings were carried out, Latakia and Tartus on the Mediterranean coast. It has banned journalists from traveling there. What happened and how many hundreds of people were killed is unclear. It started when gunmen loyal to the former regime ambushed government security forces Thursday. Government fighters and militias not under government control rushed in. Most of those killed were civilians from the Alawite religious minority to which Assad belonged. The Alawite are an offshoot of Shia Islam. Government forces are mostly Sunni Islamists. The killings have inflamed sectarian tensions. Shara pledged to put weapons only in the hands of government forces. But many minorities don't believe he wants to or can. Years before Shara gathered opposition fighters who took Damascus, he was a member of Al-Qaeda. Syria now has no army, no police force. And many of the militants who support him are beyond his control. In Damascus on Sunday, Syrians called for unity, chanting, "The Syrian people are one." But at another equally large protest 3 days before, demonstrators chanted sectarian slogans. "Syria is Arab Sunni, whether Alawites like it or not," went one. The killings have terrified not just Alawites, but Syrians from other religious minorities. In Soweto, where most of Syria's Druze religious minority live, fighters have stockpiled weapons left by regime soldiers when they fled. Access to the area is controlled by Druze fighters, not government forces. The commander of a new militia, the Soweto Military Council, tells us he has thousands of volunteers to defend the land. "Everyone wants to kill us," says Tafiq Ashoufi, the commander. "We were born in this country and we will die in this country." Later, he meets with men from the villages. They've offered to take in Alawite families. And they say they are ready to fight. Jane Araf, NPR News, Soweto, Syria.
This is NPR News. Thank you.
on the next Fresh Air. Comic Bill Burr talks about his anger issues, which are hilarious on stage, but not so much in real life, and how therapy, mushrooms, and becoming a father have helped. The interview was a wild ride, which I really enjoyed. He has a new Hulu comedy special and is a star of the new Broadway revival of Glengarry Glen Ross. Join us.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from the Cy Sims Foundation, partnering with organizations and people since 1985, working for a better and more just future for all. More information is available at cysimsfoundation.org. From Procter & Gamble, maker of Metamucil psyllium fiber supplements to support daily digestive health by trapping and removing waste. Learn more at metamucil.com. From Progressive Insurance with Snapshot, a personalized program that bases rates on safe driving habits at progressive.com. Not available in California or from all agents. And from the William T. Grant Foundation, supporting research to improve the lives of young people at WTGrantFDN.org.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep.
And I'm A. Martinez. People gathered at an arena in Canada's capital and heard the results of a vote for the leader of the governing party.
In first place, the next Prime Minister of Canada, Mark Carney, with 131,674 votes, resulting in...
Mark Carney won a kind of mini-election among Liberal Party members, and his landslide win means he will now replace Prime Minister Justin Trudeau, who's leaving office just as Canada faces a confrontation with the United States.
NPR's international affairs correspondent Jackie Northam has been following the story. So a new chapter in Canadian politics. What can you tell us about Mark Carney?
Well, up until a few months ago, not a lot of Canadians knew who Mark Carney was. He was considered a political outsider. It was only after Justin Trudeau announced that he was stepping aside in January that Carney threw his hat into the ring for the Liberal Party's leadership race. You know, but Carney, who's 59 years old, does have a reputation internationally. He comes from the world of finance and has spent time on Wall Street and was ahead of the Bank of England, where he helped navigate the post-Brexit turbulence. And he also headed up the Bank of Canada. So that experience could be critical as he becomes Prime Minister, both to tackle Canada's economic challenges right now, but certainly to deal with President Trump's trade policies towards Canada, which frankly are seen by many in Canada as economic warfare.
Yeah, relations between the two have grown contentious since Donald Trump returned to office. So is there any sense of how Carney will approach President Trump and his policies?
Well, I suspect it'll be a much different dynamic between Carney and Trump than it was with the president and Prime Minister Trudeau. They didn't get along. And in fact, over the past few weeks, relations between the two men were really fraying. You know, Trump calling Trudeau governor and Trudeau calling the president Donald and quoting an editorial saying the tariffs were a very dumb idea. So Carney could represent a fresh start, but he has warned that he would be very tough on Trump, which is something he indicated in his acceptance speech on Sunday.
We didn't ask for this fight, but Canadians are always ready when someone else drops the gloves. So the Americans, they should make no mistake, in trade as in hockey, Canada will win.
And if President Trump goes ahead with these steep tariffs on Canadian products, and that's expected in April, it could drive Canada's economy into a recession.
And here's the thing. I mean, Carney might not even be prime minister that long. I mean, there are general elections coming up this year. So when are those?
Well, they need to be held by the end of October. You know, the Liberals have bounced back in a big way in the polls, thanks largely to Trump, and his treatment of Canada has created this wave of enthusiasm, you know, both for the Liberal Party, you know, and just sort of nationalism. And Carney could grab on to that enthusiasm and call an election soon. The opposition could also launch a non-confidence vote when Parliament resumes later this month. That, too, could trigger an early election. But, you know, as it stands right now, once Carney is sworn in as Canada's new prime minister, and that could happen later this week, he'll lead the country.
All right. That's NPR's international affairs correspondent, Jackie Northam. Jackie, thanks.
Thanks very much.
Philadelphia has cheesesteak, Buffalo has chicken wings, and Rhode Island has Olneyville, New York system wieners. Did you know this? I did not know this. But now we do, thanks to The Publix Radio, which is based in Rhode Island, and David Wright has a report on a change at a local institution.
Lunchtime finds George Sakosha working the grill right by the window at Olneyville, New York System in Providence, as he has done off and on since 1973.
So what exactly is the New York System?
The New York System is actually a generic term for restaurants only in Rhode Island that sell these hot wings. They call it the system because of the setup of the restaurant. You got the stools, you got the bar, this is the system.
Don't you dare call it a hot dog joint. L.A. has Pink's, of course Coney Island has Nathan's, but this place is different.
We sell a product here that you can't get anywhere else in the country.
A product known locally by a few different names.
Gaggers, Destroyers, Greek Lobsters.
They may look like hot dogs, but George says a true Rhode Island wiener is flat at the ends.
That's because they come the way hot dogs used to a generation ago on a rope. We have a guy who cuts them every day fresh. Beef, pork, and veal.
Served up in a bun and garnished all the way.
Mustard sauce, onions, and celery. That's all the way.
And what is this meat sauce you're putting on?
This is our famous meat sauce. One guy in the family knows this recipe. We're pushing 80 years. I think it's more closely guarded than Coca-Cola, but I'm just, you know, I'm joking.
I don't want to know.
Bill Bryan says it doesn't matter what's in the meat sauce. What's important is that it stayed the same since he was a kid.
It's a classic. I mean, it's an institution. It's a Rhode Island thing.
How often do you come?
Not as often as I probably should.
Or maybe not.
Or maybe not. Depending on what your cardiologist has to say.
Exactly.
He and his friend Mark Soprano practically grew up here.
Late nights when I was younger, and now we're here. Hasn't changed a bit. Hopefully it stays the same way.
A lot of the customers worry it might change because the family that's owned Olneyville, New York System since 1946 wants to retire. They've sold the business to new owners. Matt Ijack picked up his order to go.
You don't want something to just become a Starbucks, you know?
The new owners say they'll keep things just as they are. That goes for the menu and the staff.
I have lemonade, fruit punch, iced tea, bottled water, coffee milk.
Rhode Island style's got to be coffee milk.
You want to try a coffee milk? Sure. Give me a coffee milk up for Dave.
Coffee milk is another Rhode Island thing. A glass of milk with coffee-flavored syrup.
Here goes my first bite.
Ah, yes.
Mmm. That's excellent.
I can tell you stories. People come from all over the planet. No exaggeration. Did you know this place won a James Beard Award?
Really?
Really.
Rhode Island, all the way. For NPR News, I'm David Wright.
This is NPR News.
First, scientists figured out how to restore movement to people who are paralyzed. Then, they realized picking up a cup is easier if you can feel it.
They hooked me up to the machine, and like, it was the first time I felt my index finger, and I'm like, whoa.
I'm Elsa Chang, how scientists are engineering a sense of touch on the next All Things Considered from NPR News.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Windsor Johnston. Congress is up against the clock this week to pass a spending bill to keep the government funded through September. NPR's Susan Davis reports instead of passing the annual 12 spending bills, Republicans want to keep federal agencies running under last year's budget numbers.
Passing all 12 of those bills usually requires an incredible amount of party unity and would also have likely required bipartisan negotiations with Democrats. Democrats. Republicans aren't all that interested in that path right now. They really don't want to burn all of this political capital on spending bills because the party is way more focused on passing a separate budget bill to extend President Trump's tax cuts. That is the priority focus for the Republican Party over the next several months because they expire at the end of the year.
NPR Susan Davis. Homeland Security Secretary Kristi Noem is pledging to step up lie detector tests on employees. She says it's to identify workers who may be leaking information about migrant deportation operations to the media.
The authorities that I have under the Department of Homeland Security are broad and extensive, and I plan to use every single one of them to make sure that we're following the law, that we are following the procedures in place to keep people safe, and that we're making sure we're following through on what President Trump has promised, that he's going to make America safe again.
Noem says the department's top priority is to carry out President Trump's deportation agenda. This is NPR. The week following the switch from standard to daylight saving time is difficult for many people. Some may be feeling extra sluggish or irritable this morning. As Sarah Bowden reports, the time change brings a higher incidence of car accidents, heart attacks, and strokes.
The time change disrupts our circadian rhythm, which is our body's internal clock. It not only regulates sleep, but also our metabolism, body temperature, mood, aspects of cognition, several hormones. Dr. Karin Johnson is a neurologist and sleep medicine specialist at the University of Massachusetts Chan School of Medicine, Bay State. She says getting natural light in the morning can help you adjust.
So maximizing that morning light. And then on the other hand, we don't want to get too much light at night.
Johnson says it would be better for our health to stay on standard time the entire year. For NPR News, I'm Sarah Bowden.
Plans to remove the iconic Black Lives Matter street mural in Washington, D.C. get underway today. The decision to erase it comes a week after Republicans in the House introduced legislation giving the city an ultimatum: remove it or risk losing federal funding. The mural was painted on the street in front of the White House in 2020 after peaceful protesters were tear gassed by police. The demonstrations were part of a nationwide outcry over the death of George Floyd, who was killed by police in Minneapolis. This is NPR.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from Bank of America. From local shops to global enterprises, Bank of America is committed to helping businesses of all sizes make every move matter. Learn more at bankofamerica.com/bankingforbusiness. From Indeed, committed to giving job listings increased visibility with relevant candidates through its sponsored jobs feature. Learn more at indeed.com/NPR. And from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation at macfound.org.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Martinez in Los Angeles, California.
And I'm Steve Inskeep in Washington, D.C. The General Services Administration is a federal agency that supports all the other federal agencies. It manages federal government buildings. And we have news about the GSA. The Trump administration has discussed cutting up to a quarter of federal office space and slashing the number of GSA employees who keep the buildings operating. NPR Stephen Fowler is one of four reporters who worked on this story. He's on the line. Stephen, good morning.
Good morning.
Okay, so this is an effort led by DOGE, Department of Government Efficiency, this entity purportedly led by Elon Musk. What are they doing?
Well, according to Doge's, quote, wall of receipts, there's been a ton of leases that have been terminated across the country. We found places like an IRS Taxpayer Assistance Center in Parkersburg, West Virginia, the Bureau of Indian Affairs Osage Agency in Pawhuska, Oklahoma, a Social Security office in Lewiston, Idaho, and a Farm Service Agency office in the heart of Hurricane Helene-struck western North Carolina. GSA also posted a list of more than 400 buildings deemed not core to government operations, like Washington, D.C. agency headquarters, federal courthouses, the Justice Department headquarters, and GSA itself. Some of those buildings were deleted from that list, which was entirely taken offline last week.
Okay, well, agency headquarters would seem to be core to government operations. So what is the potential effect of all of these buildings going on lists and back off again?
Well, almost all of these buildings are actually outside of D.C., and a lot of them provide public services. I mean, think about how many people need to interact with the IRS and Social Security. There are more than 100 buildings on this list from those two agencies. There's also disparate impact on rural areas, like the Farm Service Agency and Forest Service within the Agriculture Department, and Interior Department bureaus like the National Parks and the Fish and Wildlife Service. There's also U.S. Attorney's offices on the list here, and that's not to mention those massive buildings that could be sold. Like, here's a question, how do you have a federal court with no courthouse?
Okay, well, don't know the answer to that question, but let me pose another. What seems to be happening here?
Well, Doge claims to focus on, quote, waste, fraud, and abuse. And my colleagues Shannon Bond, Jenna McLaughlin, and Chris Arnold have spoken with current and former GSA staffers who say this breakneck pace of lease terminations and proposed building sales gives no evidence of any sort of plan to target waste, fraud, and abuse. GSA has fired more than 1,000 employees within its Public Building Service Division, with plans for more to come. There are entire regions of the country right now left with just a skeleton crew of workers to maintain these buildings, no matter how many of them there end up actually being. Steve, it's like Doge's other interactions with different parts of the government. There's a lot of confusion, seemingly indiscriminate firings, and no clear answers on what comes next.
Okay, let's remember another aspect of this. Some federal workers were still working from home. A lot of federal workers are doing hybrid arrangements where they came in some days, didn't come in other days. When you terminate the lease for the building, at the same time that you tell people to return to work more, what happens?
Well, the Trump administration is asking some federal workers to start showing up in the office. GSA says they're exploring all options for leases and selling buildings. They announced something called Space Match that basically amounts to turning government office buildings into co-working spaces. But people have security concerns, especially national security concerns about sensitive data. We've also already seen traffic jams for offices that implemented return to work mandates without a plan for what happens when there's way more people than space.
NPR's Stephen Fowler, thanks for showing up for work.
Thank you.
State court elections used to be quiet, but with issues such as abortion and redistricting on the line in recent years, that has all changed. Wisconsin Public Radio's Anya Van Wagtendonk reports on how we got to this expensive and combative new normal.
2 years ago, a race to fill an open seat on the Wisconsin Supreme Court shattered spending records.
This has been one of the most closely watched and expensive elections of the year.
The most expensive judicial race in American history.
And what's being called one of the most important elections ahead of 2024.
An estimated $56 million poured into the Badger State. It's a nonpartisan court, but liberals saw a chance to take the majority from conservatives for the first time in 15 years, and they did. Now another high-stakes contest for the court is brewing. For conservatives, it's an opportunity to win back the majority by supporting former Republican Attorney General Brad Schimmel. Liberals want to hold on to the majority by supporting Susan Crawford, who once worked for a Wisconsin Democratic governor. Both sides know that issues like abortion, labor, and voting rights are on the line. The race, set for April 1st, is already bitter.
If someone ever hurt my wife or kids, I don't know what I would do. But I know Brad Schimmel wouldn't do a damn thing.
No one is safe with dangerous liberal judges like Catch and Release Crawford.
And it's on track to beat those spending records from 2 years ago. This is a big change for state court races, says Damon Kahn, a political scientist at Utah State University.
For so long, judicial elections were calm, quiet, non-contested, often literally non-contested.
The first political TV ad in U.S. history was in 1952 for Dwight Eisenhower's presidential campaign. The first TV ad for a judicial race didn't run for another 5 decades. Kahn says that coincided with a new era in judicial elections. Interest groups became much more aware of the importance of state courts. And then so did voters after the U.S. Supreme Court struck down Roe v. Wade.
In a post-Dobbs world where states have more say in what abortion policy looks like across the states, it makes state courts more relevant.
Abortion is a super salient issue for court races nationwide, according to Douglas Keith of the Brennan Center. But other major political issues are being decided by state courts, too.
Fights about redistricting, fights around election laws in the lead up to high-profile elections, fights about education funding and criminal justice and the death penalty.
In the last year, dozens of state Supreme Court seats went up for grabs. Keith says huge dollars also flowed into races in Ohio and Pennsylvania. And the dust is still settling in a race for the North Carolina Supreme Court from last November. The outcome of that election is being contested in, yes, state court. But this year, Wisconsin is looking like it will once again host the highest profile race of all as both sides fight for ideological control. That's motivated one of the richest people in the world, Elon Musk, to throw his weight behind the conservative candidate. He's given more than $3 million to the Schimmel campaign, with more on the way. And on liberal candidate Crawford's side, there's LinkedIn founder Reid Hoffman, Illinois Governor J.B. Pritzker, and George Soros, who have so far donated nearly $2 million combined. Keith says that we should get used to these big battles for control of state courts.
There's every indication that this new era of state judicial politics is here to stay.
The Wisconsin Supreme Court is in the middle of hearing a lawsuit to overturn a 19th century abortion ban, and a challenge to a law that undermined most public sector unions is pending. In a state with a Democratic governor and a Republican-held legislature, holding the nonpartisan court is one way to push partisan priorities. For NPR News, I'm Anya Van Wagtendonk.
This is NPR News.
As Roberta Flack is celebrated, we'll meet the woman who she thanked for writing this song. Lori Lieberman, next time, Here and Now.
Staying informed is more vital than ever. With NPR by your side, it is easy to keep up with the latest news. We're at your fingertips on your phone. Listen live at this station's website or npr.org.
Good morning, I'm Amy Martinez. A gym about 40 miles north of New York City is closed after a car drove through an emergency exit door on Friday. Now, no one was hurt and no equipment damaged because it crashed straight into the pool house and didn't stop until its two front wheels were in the pool, kind of like if you were to put your toes in the water. Local police had a quip ready to go. Quote, while we do encourage carpooling, this is not what we had in mind. It's Morning Edition.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from Fisher Investments, Fisher is committed to helping clients stay on track to reach their financial goals and enjoy a comfortable retirement. FisherInvestments.com. Investing in securities involves the risk of loss. From Procter & Gamble, maker of ZzzQuil, with a range of products designed to relieve occasional sleeplessness to help people fall asleep. Learn more at ZzzQuil.com. And from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation at MacFound.org.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm E. Martinez.
And I'm Steve Inskeep. American sports fans know tailgating, showing up at the stadium a few hours early to party in the parking lot, which is what I used to do at Purdue football games. Reporter Nat Herz was at the World Cross Country Ski Championships in Norway over the weekend and found that trailgating requires more commitment.
John Hammerness and his wife and kids wanted to be sure to get a good spot to watch the championships in the forest near the central Norwegian city of Trondheim. So they got here early.
We set up the tent 3 weeks ago.
3 weeks ago?
To reserve the place.
I find them frying bacon over hot coals, sitting on reindeer and sheep skins next to the 30 bags of firewood that Hammerness hauled in from a parking lot.
We have also a fireplace inside the tent. It's nice and cozy. You can sit in a t-shirt.
Organizers say as many as 20,000 fans are in the woods here to watch their national heroes glide past and try to conquer the rival Swedes. Ragnar Hoas, another fan, explains.
You know, all the Norwegians are born with the skis, so the traditional Norwegian heritage is to go skiing. We like to see our athletes. We are very happy when they are winning. But of course, we allow the Swedish neighbors to win sometimes.
Hoas was one of another 30,000 people who watched in the enormous stadium. Think American football, but replace the gridiron with a ski trail that winds out and up into the forest. Norway's men's team has won a slew of gold medals, as have the Swedish women, but American Jesse Diggins made the podium as well. The top-ranked female skier in the world coming into this competition, Diggins struggled with her equipment, but she did win a silver medal.
I had to keep believing in myself and believing in my body and taking care of my body and knowing that it will come. We will nail it. All the skis, the wax, the glide, my body, it will all come together on the right day. And I had to keep that faith. But that does not come easily. It's work. And I think it's okay to acknowledge that.
Diggins finished second in the team sprint with Julia Kern. She's one of a few top U.S. prospects who are coming into their own just in time for next year's Olympics. Kern is also involved in a big off-trail story. These races score big TV ratings in Europe, and climate campaigners were threatening to disrupt them over oil company sponsorship. But Kern and another American, Alaskan Gus Schumacher, led international athletes in negotiations that prompted the group to stand down. Here's Schumacher.
It's kind of easy to be like in your house where you don't feel a lot of the changes, but you know, like we're at Fairbanks latitude in Norway, and it's 50 degrees, and it's barely March, you know, and like Anchorage is out of snow, which sucks. And those are like small problems in the full like Earth climate issue, but yeah, it's like where we see it.
The agreement says the athletes will work with the campaigners to phase out fossil fuel sponsorship of major international ski events, and to prioritize advertising deals with companies that commit to climate leadership and the long-term future of winter sport. Kern says that rainy, sloppy conditions in Trondheim underscored the importance of the climate work, but the weather barely dampened the enthusiasm of the Norwegian crowd. For NPR News, I'm Nat Herz in Trondheim.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep.
And I'm A. Martinez.
Thank you.
Why markets are so upset this morning.
Marketplace Morning Report is supported by Bank of America. From local shops to global enterprises, Bank of America is committed to helping businesses of all sizes make every move matter. Learn more at bankofamerica.com/bankingforbusiness.
From Marketplace, I'm Sabri Benishore, in for David Brancaccio. Markets this morning are in bad shape as investors worry about the direction of the economy. The Dow is down a full percent, 434 points. The S&P 500 is down 2.1%. The NASDAQ is down 3.5%. And the yield on the 10-year Treasury, that's falling. It's at 4.25%. That's what happens when investors look for safety. The VIX, that's a measure of market volatility, that is up 14% this morning. It is not a mystery why markets have been responding this way. Economic policy out of the White House has been unstable, and that's made the business environment uncertain for a lot of companies and consumers. President Donald Trump this weekend did little to clear things up, declining to rule out the possibility of a recession. Marketplace's Nova Sappho has more.
On Fox News this weekend, President Trump was asked whether the U.S. economy could be headed for a recession this year as layoffs, federal spending cuts, and tariffs take a toll.
I hate to predict things like that. There is a period of transition because what we're doing is very big.
A period of transition. Last week, Trump's Treasury Secretary Scott Bessent suggested something similar.
The market and the economy have just become hooked. We've become addicted to this government spending, and there's going to be a detox period.
It's not just about government spending, though. Markets moved sharply lower after Trump imposed tariffs on Canada and Mexico. Nearly all economists polled by Reuters last week said recession risks have risen in all three countries. Commerce Secretary Howard Lutnick on NBC's Meet the Press over the weekend called all of this not a transition, but...
Will there be distortions? Of course. Foreign goods may get a little more expensive, but American goods are going to get cheaper.
Economists dispute that cheaper assertion. The administration plans to levy 25% tariffs on steel and aluminum imports this Wednesday. I'm Nova Sappho for Marketplace.
Canadian convenience store giant ACT, they own Circle K convenience stores, among others, it plans to take over the company that owns 7-Eleven, Japanese firm 7&I Holdings. The two are in talks to make that happen, specifically to sell certain convenience stores to avoid accusations of creating a monopoly.
Marketplace Morning Report is supported by Progressive Insurance, offering small business owners protection for what they've worked hard to build with over 30 customizable coverages. Learn more at progressivecommercial.com. And by Schwab. Schwab offers investors choices like full-service wealth management, self-directed investing options, and trading on thinkorswim. More at schwab.com.
Now to our Economic Pulse series, where we do regular checkups on the economy from a range of different perspectives. And today, we're talking about the difference between how so many of us feel about the economy and what the official statistics say about it. Gene Ludwig is chair of the Ludwig Institute for Shared Economic Prosperity and former U.S. Comptroller of the Currency. He joined my colleague David Brancaccio.
People's lived experience tell us that the economy needs work. Yet, I mean, I end up reporting a lot of these. The headline economic numbers have been saying things are actually A-OK. Maybe we should stop whining. How do you resolve this great divide over numbers versus what we see with our eyes?
We started looking at this back about, five, 6 years ago when we held a symposium to question why things felt bad for middle and low income Americans. But at the time, the headline statistics were looking pretty good. So I decided with the Institute to begin to study the numbers and try to figure out why the folks at that symposium and in my own experience growing up in a small town in Pennsylvania and seeing it deteriorate, you know, why is this disconnect between what these headline numbers tell us every day and what we're experiencing?
Some of it is we do the monthly unemployment rate. It is a crucial piece of data, but the headline one does not account for people who are so discouraged by the job market that they look at. Sometimes the payroll count that the Labor Department does, yeah, look at all these people who got jobs this month, but maybe they were working multiple jobs.
Well, all that is absolutely true, but sadly, it's even worse than that. Mm. What it doesn't account for is people who have a piece of a job. They work an hour or two here and there, but they want a full-time job. It doesn't account for that. If they worked 1 hour in the last 2 weeks, they're counted as being employed. It doesn't in any way suggest whether the person can earn even above a poverty wage. So unemployment, as we'd like to say it, functional unemployment, it's really in the 20s, which is horrifying. And for people of color, it's much worse.
Many orders of magnitude higher than the headline figure that they hand me every month when the unemployment rate comes out.
That's only one of the headline statistics that's misleading. The inflation rate is also misleading. CPI is what it's called, Consumer Price Index, is a basket of 80,000 goods and services. But for middle and low income Americans, they use a relatively narrow group that matter to them most, which is food, housing, education, transportation to work. And if you look at the basic things that they can afford to buy, they have inflated over the last 20 years more rapidly than the CPI. So they're worse off. And that is a big deal because it means that net net, their wages haven't increased over the last 20 years. For 60% of America, they've actually declined or been stagnant.
I mean, I remember we used to spend a lot of time when I was a kid focused on the misery index to gauge people's well-being. But see, that was built on the faulty unemployment number that you were talking about. It was, I think, unemployment rate plus inflation equals misery. We need something better, I guess.
We do indeed. And we'll be coming out with, over the next couple of months, a shared economic prosperity index and a minimum quality of life measure that together will give the country a sense of how people in the middle class are doing in reality.
Eugene Ludwig is founder of the Ludwig Institute for Shared Economic Prosperity and was U.S. Controller of the Currency in the early to late 90s. Gene, thank you very much.
It's nice to be with you.
Gene was speaking with Marketplace's David Brancaccio there. In New York, I'm Sabri Benishore with the Marketplace Morning Report. From APM, American Public Media.